Today's reading is from Mark. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain. For he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart, and the shackles he broke into pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed before him. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Good job, Gabby. Thank you very much. Well, what do these people have in common? Winston Churchill, Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes, Brooke Shields, Jim Carrey, Ellen DeGeneres, Indiana's own Jane Pauley, Drew Barrymore, Dick Clark, Woody Allen, Sting, Billy Joel, Robin Williams, Monica Seles, Ty Cobb, Greg Louganis, John Keats, Tolstoy, Lord Byron, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Edgar Allan Poe, Dickens, Hemingway. I could go on and on with a long list of celebrities. You probably know by the topic, what do you think they have in common? They all experience depression. They all experience some form of depression, some of them to the point of attempting to take their lives. Depression is so very widespread, and yet you probably look at some of those names and go, wow, I didn't know that. Like, much of the world was so shocked with the suicide of Robin Williams. We'd say, wow, how could somebody with so much energy, so much laughter, who brings joy to the world, suffer to that kind of depth? Probably because depression continues to be a giant stigma in America. It's like this secret we're afraid to talk about, perhaps because recent studies show that over a quarter of the American population still believes that it's a weakness on a person's part, that they're just weak in being able to deal with the realities of life. Maybe that's why people feel that they need to suffer quietly. That's why we're doing and talking about a series dealing with depression. You know, I have not worked as hard for a series in some time. I've been meeting with lots of people. I've been talking to professionals. I have been reading books and articles and magazines, and yet I still don't know what I'm talking about because I've not had the experience of the people I've listened to. They've described things to me that I at least feel thankful that that's not an experience that I've had. And it makes me feel, wow, how can I get up and even begin to talk about this topic when I don't know firsthand what that's like? And yet, we got to talk about it. Think about some other statistics. 19 million Americans deal with depression in some form. According to the National Network of Depression Centers, 1 in 5 Americans has firsthand experience of some type of mood disorder, 1 in 5. Depressive illnesses represents over, get this now, $210 billion in lost productivity and medical cost. According to the World Health Organization, it's going to be the number one health concern in the world by 2030. Depression will be the number one health concern. And this is what gets alarming about the future. Since 1915, diagnosed cases of depression have doubled in each successive generation. Each generation since 1915 has doubled its number of diagnosed clinical depressions. Onset at age 32, some studies say in the 20s of people, and it's showing up at an increasingly alarming rate for children. So we're living in a world in which more and more people are dealing with depression. Roughly 15% of depressed people will take their lives. According to Terrence Real, a psychologist, 60 to 80% of people with depression never receive help, despite the fact that 80 to 90% of people who receive help in the form of medication and therapy get relief. 80 to 90% who get help say, I'm in a much better place today. And yet 60 to 80% do not seek help. John Grierden, director of the Mental Health Research Institute at the University of Michigan, says actually only about 1 to 2% of people who receive help get effective help. So it's a very small number, and it's something that we need to talk about. But many people would say, okay, I get why we need to talk about it. Just why do we need to talk about it now? I mean, isn't it depressing enough to come to church on a snowy, icy morning and it's dark and after the holidays? I mean, honestly, after the last service, I felt like we should have been passing out Prozac to the congregation. And I'm sure we've got some Lily people here in the church who could hook us up. But you know why we talk about it now? Because this is Epiphany. Epiphany is the season following Easter that celebrates the arrival of the wise men by the guidance of the star. So light becomes an important theme in Epiphany. One of the central psalms of Epiphany is, "Arise and shine, for your light has come." This is the announcement that the one who brings light to the world is in our world for all people. So we've called this series Longing for Light, because we all long for light in some form or another. So what I want to do today is I want to talk about the experience of depression. I want to use a story in a moment to think about what the experience of depression is like and to think about the experiences that help to combat depression. Next week, I want to think about the messages that depression sends us and what are the messages that we need to combat that. And then on the third week, we're going to talk about how do you help somebody who's going through depression? How do you help a loved one in your family or a friend? How can we be the best help to others? So let's start today, and there's an outline in your bulletin if you haven't grabbed that already that you can use to follow along in the message. And I want to start in thinking about the experience of depression with a story from the Gospel of Mark that I invite us to consider from an allegorical perspective. Now, that's a very important qualifier, and let me explain why. Let's think about a definition for allegorical. This comes from Webster's Dictionary. The meaning of allegorical, having hidden spiritual meaning that transcends the literal sense of a sacred text. Now, that didn't come from a book of theology. That's Webster's Dictionary. That's an important perspective in which to approach this story to focus on depression, because it's a story about a demon-possessed man. And I don't want us to think about depression as demonic, but to think about how the idea of possession could actually hold hidden spiritual meaning that goes beyond the literal understanding of the text. Another thing we have to remember is in the time of Scripture, many physical manifestations and symptoms of illness that was not easily explainable or understood was often relegated to being a demon or some kind of an evil spirit. In another story in the Bible, a person who showed symptoms of epilepsy was considered to be demon-possessed. So let's put it in that context. But if we begin with this idea that perhaps there can be hidden meaning in this notion of possession, then one of the first things that we realize is depression feels like something has a hold on you. Depression feels like something has a hold on you. Andrew Solomon in 2001 wrote a book about his incredible deep experience of depression. And of all things, you know what he named his book? The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression. If you ever want to watch a very helpful 30-minute dissection of what depression is like that also ends on a hopeful note. Google Andrew Solomon TED Talk on depression. Andrew Solomon TED Talk on depression. Very, very insightful. He actually says it is like having an invading spirit in you. That's how he refers to it. His image for depression, he found when he returned to a wooded area where he grew up as a kid, and there was a big giant oak tree he used to go and play in. He would climb up and be in the branches, and when he went back to this tree as an adult, he saw that a vine had wrapped around the tree and had kind of grown up and like taken over the tree. And in the middle of summer, he said you couldn't distinguish the leaves from the vine from the leaves of the tree. And he just looked at that and he went, that's my experience. That's what my depression looks like. My depression looks like that. Like something that just has a hold on me that I can't just will it away. So go back to the man in this story. Look at how his life is described. It says, first of all, he lived in the tombs. One of the two symptoms of depression is hopelessness. Is there anything more hopeless than a tomb? A tomb doesn't have a future. This man lived in a place where there's no future, there's no hope. It describes this man's living in a place of hopelessness. The second thing we learn is he was chained. People tried to chain him. The second symptom of depression is helplessness. Hopelessness and helplessness. When you're chained, your options are taken away, aren't they? And when you try to break free and you don't feel like you can, it's like you shouldn't even bother. And part of the struggle of depression is it can wrap around a person and convince them that anything you do to feel better is not going to work. So don't even try. Why get up in the morning? Why exercise? Why eat right? Why try to do any of the things that might help? Because I'm just convinced. It's like I'm chained. It's not going to matter anyway. So when people try to help and they say to folks, hey, you know, just snap out of it. Hey, just cheer up. Or they try to say, well, look at all these great things going on. Just feel better. You might as well be speaking another language. Because when you're chained, unless somebody can help you take off your chains, it's not going to help. So then the third thing we know about this man is he cut himself. He cut himself with stones. In major severe depression, it can lead to a place where we become harmful to ourselves. Sigmund Freud's classic definition of depression is anger or aggression turned inward. That's one of the first real definitions from psychiatry of depression. Anger or aggression turned inward. And in a severe form of depression, what can start out as low self-esteem can lead to a place where we just feel like we're totally worthless. What have we got to live for? And when that thought appears, it's almost like we can't help going down that trail. Even if we don't take physical action on ourselves, we can so isolate our lives, we can put ourselves in a place where it really does feel like we might as well be dead. And that's what happened to this man in the story with Jesus. He had isolated himself from community. He had lived alone. It's like he was living as a dead person, walking among the tombs. This is what the experience of depression can feel like to many people. So what do you do about it? What can you do when you're in a place of helplessness and hopelessness? In your outline, here's where I'd like for us to jump down a little bit. And in fact, before we even do that, let me also set up something I think is very important on this first Sunday, and that is to understand what we're talking about when we say the word depression. I mean, that's a big word. And it covers a really big spectrum. There's one end of depression that can be mild, and to be honest, it's probably the normal types of depression every person goes through. If you go through a divorce, if you move to a new location, if you change jobs, if you've experienced a grief personally, I mean, all of these things can cause a depression. They make us sad, right? But we can find that we can move out of them. If we can't do it ourselves, then maybe with therapy, with medication, we find that we can still function, we can still manage. Sometimes that kind of sadness can become more of a clinical depressive disorder, but it's not debilitating. With medication, we find that we can keep functioning. We can keep managing life. But then it can become major severe depression, and that's where depression is debilitating. We don't function anymore. I mean, we can't get out of bed in the morning. I found this very interesting talking with people who've dealt with depression. They said something that was opposite of what I thought. I thought more people would deal with depression in the evening when it gets dark. They said, no, it's morning. The morning is the worst. Because when you feel like I can't face the world, I really don't have it in me to go to work. I can't make a meal for my family. I can't wash clothes. I don't have it within me. The morning is the worst because that's when you're confronted with doing the impossible. So when it gets to that place, it's a major depression. And then it can become severe to the point of suicidal thoughts or taking your life. Even manic depression, which is also called bipolar depression, when there is that extreme behavior, not just the deep troughs, but then the mania, the euphoria, and the going back and forth. So when you say depression, it's like, wow, that's all over the board. And there are a lot of different contributing factors. Sometimes it is the normal life experiences, like I talked about. Sometimes it's sickness. Sickness is a big contributing factor to depression. 25% of cancer patients experience some form of depression. Chronic pain contributes big time to depression. When you're living in a lot of pain, you tend to become depressed. Diabetes is another big contributor. I sat down yesterday with Dr. Mary DeGroot, who teaches at the IU School of Medicine. Her area of focus has been diabetes and depression. And she wanted me to promote a program that is for type 2 diabetes patients who deal with depression. The program is called ACTIVE. And here's a website, programactive.iupui.edu. And if you are a type 2 diabetes patient, and you'd like to find out about this program because you've been dealing with depression, she said there are openings and you're more than welcome to. If you want to speak directly with her, if you'll get in touch with me, I'll put you in touch with Dr. DeGroot. So sickness can be an important contributor, but then there's biology. And biology can be chemical imbalance in the body. It can sometimes be inherited genes that predispose us to depression. So there can be biological reasons, but then there can be one more, and that is wounds or trauma. Sometimes depression is the result of things we're doing our very best not to feel. Hurts and wounds that we've tried to forget. Consciously, we might not even be aware that we're doing this, but subconsciously, what we're trying to do is depress those emotions, and that takes a lot of energy to do. We're not even aware we're doing it, but our emotional selves are pushing some stuff down that over time, the dam can begin to break. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves overwhelmed by a deep depression, and we're not even aware of what caused it. And that's where medication and therapy together are so essential. So now let's get back to the outline. When you're going through depression, what's the hope? What can you do about it? Here's where I want us to jump down to letter C. And then we'll come back to B. The first step is naming the problem. naming the problem. Go back to the man in the story with Jesus. Jesus asked him, "What's your name?" Now, he's not talking to the man, is he? He's talking to the spirit inside of him. There was an old cultic belief that to know the name of a foreign spirit gave you power over that spirit. Now, that all seems very weird talking about depression, doesn't it? But think about the importance of taking the first step as naming the problem. What Jesus is doing in this story is getting the upper hand. Jesus is getting the upper hand on this invading spirit that is robbing the life of this person. Sometimes dealing with depression means we really do have to name it. I think I'm depressed. I'm not functioning as well as I'd like to. The number one people in our world who identify that we're dealing with depression, who would you think that is? It's not a pastor. It's not a friend. It's not a family member. It's not a counselor. Primary care physician. 95% of cases are recognized first by a primary care physician. So what is important to be talking about with your doctor? Not just whether your digestive system is working right. It's to say, you know what, I'm not sleeping well. I know this doesn't have anything to do with my physical health, but I've just been overcome with feelings of anxiety lately. I just can't get over this. I'm not eating right. I mean, whatever it is that's going on, when you begin to name it, a doctor can say, whoa, let's talk about that. Who knows where that might lead, but it first has to be named. Now, go back to B. The second part is Jesus separated the problem from the person. Jesus separated the problem from the person. I love this part. Jesus said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Now, who is Jesus talking to here? He said to the man, he's talking to the person, right? But then he says, "Come out of this man." Now he's talking to the spirit. What's he doing? He's distinguishing the problem from the person. Now, this is very important. Because in depression, we become convinced that we are the problem. That everything about life is bad, that it's awful, that we even may take on feelings that we're evil, that something's wrong with us. And Jesus separates that. He says, no, let's talk about the problem, but you're also a person. You're a person who might have a problem, but you are not a problem. In other words, think of Jesus in this story as being like a great therapist. This man put himself in the care of somebody who was willing to look at him and see the possibility of living without that problem. Come out. When we really do need help, we've got to be willing to put ourselves in the care of somebody who is going to speak hope into our lives that this can be different. I want to put a different thought in your head. You're not the problem. I want to give some different information to you. Somebody we might listen to, somebody we might believe, somebody we can work with, somebody we're really willing to put ourselves in that person's hands and to trust them. Because to begin entertaining the thought that life can be different, where we do not have to be consumed with this feeling that everything is dark and nothing's worth living for, that can be different is a significant step toward hope. The last two things I want to mention, I learned from people I've talked to. These are two things I learned firsthand as a common denominator. When I sat down with people over the last number of weeks and just had them tell me their stories of depression, I looked for common denominators. What do people say that sound similar? These two things showed up over and over again, and interestingly enough, they show up in this story. When you go to letter D, You look for ways to serve. You look for ways to serve. When the man experienced freedom and this darkness was pulled out of him, he said to Jesus, I want to go with you and your disciples. And Jesus said, that's not such a good idea. And there were political reasons for that. This man was from another part of the world, and Jesus is going back to an all-Jewish community where this man's not going to fit in. But what Jesus does say is, why don't you stay here and focus on helping people? So look at how the story ends. So the man went away and told and began to tell in the Decapolis all that God had done for him. Over and over, people told me when I said, so what helped you with your depression? I said, you know, I think putting myself in a place where I was of help to other people, where I was just doing something for others, that really helped me. Some people would say, when I just started making myself cook a meal for my family, clean house, be a part of a service in the church. I didn't always feel like it. I didn't do it because I felt like it, but I just recognized that the way I felt after doing these things was always different than before. So when I didn't feel like it, I had to make myself. And when I made myself, I just realized, I would remind myself, it did put me in a better place. The psychiatrist Carl Menninger was asked by a group one time, what would you advise a person to do who's experiencing deep depression? And they all thought he was going to say, go see a psychiatrist. Listen to what he said. If you're really severely depressed, do this. Lock the door behind you, go across the street, find somebody that's in need, and do something to help them. The other thing people told me that is in this story as well is seek God's love and acceptance. Seek God's love and acceptance. This is one of the unusual stories of a healing of this kind in the Bible, because it's the one time when the man came running to Jesus. Other stories, when people have this kind of condition, they run away from Jesus. They cause trouble and Jesus comes and confronts them. This time the man runs to Jesus and he falls on his knees before him. People in our church who've been through depression have said to me, and I know that the reason I've heard this is because I've talked to people in our church, but they said, you know, putting ourselves in a place regularly, in a community, to be reminded that God loves me, I really had to hear that over and over and over and over. I had to constantly expose myself to that message that I am worth loving, because so many times I didn't believe it. But as I just continued to expose myself to that message, I believe it got inside of me and it was part of my journey to hope and healing. An important experience for combating the experience of depression is to do what we're doing right now, is to put ourselves in a place where we're being reminded that even though we do not feel lovable, we are loved. And we have to hold on to that. One of my heroes in preaching is Harry Emerson Fosdick, a giant of a preacher. He was in the pulpit of Riverside Church in New York City for many years. He tells in his autobiography, as a young man, when he hit a very depressed point, he was living at his parents' house. And he went home one day and he went upstairs to his room, and all of a sudden, this darkness just wrapped around him. And this voice in his head said, Harry, your life is not worth living. Your life is not worth living. And in that moment, he went into the restroom, took out his razor, which was a straight edge, and he put it to his throat. Right before he killed himself, he said, God, I don't want to do this. but if you can stop me, do something now. And God spoke to him in the voice of his father from downstairs, who yelled up the staircase, "Harry, are you all right, son?" He started crying and he put the razor down. He said, "My father was God's voice, reminding me that no matter what, I am loved. Somebody cares about me. Somebody's concerned about me." And I think that's the importance of corporate worship. There's something experienced in the corporate body of people we don't always get when we're just alone and we worship. But in the experience of people around us and through other voices, God uses those voices to say, "You matter. I love you." Sometimes with just a simple touch on the back, a hug in a hallway, God says, "Your presence here today, because it matters to you, matters to me, matters to everybody. You're that important and you're that special to me." And the one thing that might keep us from going through an ultimate act where we believe life is worthless, it's just holding on to the possibility that even though I don't feel it now, I'm going to believe that maybe I can feel again one day that life is worth living. And it is. And it is. Amen.